This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Happy 2021. We survived 2020! Oh my God. Oh my God, it hurts so bad. Anyway, we are back. It's a brand new to you show for you on your New Year's Day. And join us, we got two great authors. First of all, L. David Meach in his book Wolf Island, a phenomenal story about his research he did out on Wolf Island that helped us understand wolves as a whole, because once again, they didn't know that much about wolves. He started doing research out on Isle Royale. Just an amazing story that he puts out there. Also, Tom Weber, kind enough to join us, Minneapolis and Urban Biography. This is a phenomenal history book. As a matter of fact, I'm actually going to say, of all the books I interviewed, I think the Tom Weber book was my favorite this entire holiday season. So make sure you stay with us for that. It is brand new to you shows. We do this every year over the holidays. Happy New Year. Stay with us. L. David Meach joins us when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Brand new book out from L. David Meach. It is Wolf Island, Discovering the Secrets of a Mythical Animal, with Greg Brining. He's kind enough to join us today to talk about Wolf Island. Dave, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure. And I think this has become synonymous with natural research, had the ability to spend quite a bit of time out on Isle Royale, which has, for many people, has been considered a natural incubator of study between wolves and moose.
Absolutely. It's really the best little laboratory, outdoor laboratory for wolves and moose in the world.
When did you get first excited about and wanting to learn more about wolves?
Well, the island is huge, for one thing. It's 210 square miles, and it has only, as a predator, the wolf is the only major predator there, a large carnivore, and the moose is the only large herbivore on there. So it's a very simple system, and when I was given the opportunity to work there, and I've been interested in large carnivores as a kid, and I had an opportunity to do my PhD work there while I jumped on it.
And this curtails a recapping a bit of the three summers and winters that you were there on Isle Royale. When were those years?
I started in 1958, and then I was there for the next 3 years. So finished in 1962.
So, they weren't on the island, I don't believe, until, the 1940s, and then they went out there. When did it become pretty apparent that there was a unique research opportunity there on the island that the populations had held, and that you had an interesting, predator-prey, display right in front of you on Isle Royale?
Well, that was actually in the mid-50s when Dr. Durward Allen, from Purdue University, sized up the situation and thought this would be a great outdoor laboratory, and he applied for a National Science Foundation grant and received that funding in the late 1950s, and that's when he recruited me to do that, to start the thing.
Yeah, and Isle Royale, I think they had taken all the permanent residents off that island before that, or were there still some people that were living out there?
There were some people grandfathered in when it became a national park, some fishermen, commercial fishermen, and a couple of other families that had summer homes there, and they were grandfathered in so that during the summer they could be there. Nobody, no one, including the Park Service, was there in the winter at all. So basically, There was no one there from, say, Labor Day to early May or so before anyone would be coming for the summer.
There's an interesting element of this because you go out there and you're saying you're going out there for the winters. Wolves are predators, and here you are. You're going to be basically by yourself on this island with a group of wolves is definitely a super predator. And
well,
I mean, that had to be intimidating.
Yeah, and the wolves that we found there in 1959, when first time I flew over that island, and we used aircraft to do the study to follow them around with, but that first year we found that the main pack concluded 15 wolves, which is quite a good size pack.
As a young research student, I don't know if you were aware of how big that pack was. Was there ever that concern? It's like, I'm going to go on an island here where I am no longer. I mean, on the mainland, sure, you know, humans control, but here I'm back. This is going back into a time when you were to a point at the mercy of nature. I mean, did that ever cross your mind? Is that this might not be that safe at all?
Well, not really. There wasn't a lot of information about wolves at that time. But there was enough to know that probably they weren't too dangerous to people. I had to do a little exploring on my own in that regard. But I knew enough to know that I didn't think it was going to be that dangerous. That was not a problem, really.
So you're there, and by the sounds of it, once again, one of the first things that we're doing here is establishing where are the wolves, how big are these wolves packs. Were you surprised? I mean, was it truly a thriving wolf population on the island, or was it just still bits and pieces as it was building itself up?
No, it was a thriving wolf population. There's no question about that. When we first found that first pack, and we could see, with 15 animals, they were doing well. 15 is a good size pack, and they were, in fact, when we first found them, they were at a kill, and so we could see that, they were able to kill moose all right, and looked like it was a pretty good thriving community out there.
And it should also be mentioned at this point, in the mainland U.S., the wolves had pretty much been wiped out, correct?
Well, they were, their numbers were down quite a bit at that time. There were still wolves in Minnesota and Ontario, but through most of the 48 states, they'd been pretty well wiped out by then. There were some in Wisconsin in the far north and some in northern Michigan, but basically for the rest of the 48 states, they'd been wiped out, yeah.
You followed around, and I have seen some of the videos of researchers that follow wolves. It seems quite it's amazing to be able to watch, because wolves are, and I still think today, a grossly misunderstood species that is wildly intelligent with an amazing family base within them. Was it for you as you were, I mean, obviously you had a plane, that this was for, I imagine doing this kind of research in a plane was a little bit advanced at that time as well. How did it kind of present to you that you started realizing, whatever I learned in school, I'm going to learn a heck of a lot more watching these guys?
Right away, as soon as I saw them, I realized that, wow, this is going to be, we're going to be able to learn a lot here, because we were able to follow them around in the snow from the aircraft and count them and count the moose. And actually, one of the biggest or the most important things we were able to do is actually watch those wolves hunt. And not a lot of people had been able to do that before, but with this technique of following with a light aircraft, we were able to watch them interact over that whole period with 131 different moose. Mm-hmm. So I knew this was going to be, we're going to learn something.
How long, and the fact that you have the exact number of moose, I mean, how long did that take you to kind of track down the moose numbers?
Well, they're big animals, and we can count them from the air, and that's what we did, yeah.
But that's a big island. I mean, were you tagging? Were you putting radio collars on these on the moose?
Well, this was way before radio collars. Okay. Radio collars were not invented and developed until 1963. So, no, this was just, this island, I mentioned, is 210 square miles, mm-hmm. 45 miles long and 9 miles wide. So it's quite a large island. But we were able to fly strips back and forth, especially since it was long and narrow, and keep track of where we'd been and what moose we counted and where we didn't count and that kind of thing. And so it all worked out pretty well.
There's one story you talk about here that you came across a wolf kill, and you actually landed the plane, even though the pilot, was it Don Murray, was telling you no, this might not be a good idea for you to do, and you were able to get up there and get a close look at the kill, correct?
Yes, that was very interesting. There were 15 wolves around that kill. And I was interested in seeing what they had killed and before they'd eaten it all, to see if I could tell whether it was debilitated or in good condition or what. And so I persuaded him to put me down on a nearby lake and let me snowshoe in and take a look at that.
How convinced were you that the wolves, weren't going to turn on you, especially some of the wolves that might have been lower in the pack that were not getting at the moose kill? Was there any worry at all on your mind
I wasn't totally naive. I didn't know what was going to happen. The Park Service had given me a firearm to carry with me. They thought wolves were pretty dangerous and I ought to have one, so I had that thing. And I also told the pilot that if he saw the wolves coming back or coming after me to dive down through the trees, this is a small plane and a little Super Cub basically, and mm-hmm. dive down and scare them away and at least signal me that they were coming. It's hard to know what to do in that situation, but if I didn't try, I wouldn't learn anything. So, mm-hmm. So I gave it a good try.
This, what you just described, though, something you just had mentioned, shows how important your research was, is that it sounds like even the government didn't really understand wolf behavior, that there seemed to be more of the belief in the narrative that had been created around the wolf as opposed to really what wolf behavior was. And so there is, even though that, and through the research that you did, and you've learned so much, and we understand these animals so much better, that the reality is that you were there to basically, attack the myth around the wolf and get the fact.
Yes, exactly. And fortunately, we had the opportunity there to do that. And so the study ended up being, pretty productive.
Mm-hmm. I will also make sure someone's either going to think this is the worst vacation of all time or the greatest vacation. I'm on the greatest side. You were able to take, it sounds like, if you had over the summers, at least you actually had some of your family come up with you.
Yes. Yes. My wife and later on, two children, lived on a nearby island. Right off the coast of, or the shore of, Isle Royal. And, during the summer, of course, during the winter, they did not come out there. It was just the pilot and one of the Park Service rangers and myself. Mm-hmm. In the summer, it was a good place to have a little family.
Oh, you'll never. I'll be blunt. I don't think you'll ever get a better vacation. The beautiful wilderness, all to yourself, really, for the most part. I mean, that must have been spectacular.
Well, it was beautiful. It was idyllic, actually, and it was. A little different life than we have now. During the first or second summer, we had to haul in ice from the shore for the refrigerator and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
Washing machine was one, an old Maytag one that with a pedal you had to step on to start the thing and that kind of thing. But it all worked out very well, and we loved it.
Do you remember while you were there? I mean, I met, and it almost sounds too perfect. Did you hear the wolves howling at night while you were there during the summer with your family?
Oh, yes, at many different times. And in fact, we'd often try to get them to howl. At that time, I had a portable record player, and I mean, this is back in the old days, but it was a crank-up player with a vinyl recording of wolves howling and a loudspeaker, and could blast that out and try to get them to respond, and they often did. Now, nowadays, we do that ourselves with just howling like a wolf, but we didn't even know at the time that you could do that, so we had this record player that broadcast recorded howls out there, and it was great to hear the wolves howl back.
I want to step away from your book for a quick second and ask you one thing that, I mean, as a wolf expert, you know, you were there at the beginning when we started to understand these creatures better. We have brought the populations back. Now you have the current administration lifting the endangered species protections on the gray wolf here. Your thoughts on that? I mean, I get the mindset of we've spent the time and effort to bring these animals back, and now it seems like because of knee-jerk reactions from a handful of ranchers, and I don't want to dismiss the problems that ranchers might have with a predator, but at the same time, I don't know if this is necessarily it's safe enough to lift the endangered species protections on the wolves. I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, well, the wolf population in the 48 states has reached a minimum of 6,000 animals. So from a population standpoint, it's quite secure. And it has that population, including that in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, they have met the requirements for wolf recovery according to the Endangered Species Act. So the delisting, I don't think it's unusual that the government is trying to actually, they have delisted them now as of early January. The states will now get jurisdiction, and they give the wolves a certain amount of protection as well. But you're correct; there will be some that are taken, you know, for killing livestock and that kind of thing. But each of the states have certainly pledged that their main management objective is to make sure they have a healthy wolf population. So I'm not too concerned about that.
Just as an expert on this, how many wolves could we lose from that 6,000 population before you'd say, you know what, maybe we need to put them back on the endangered species list?
Oh, I would say if they get down, and it's sort of done almost on a state-by-state basis, but like, for example, in Minnesota, the plans that have been derived for determining this said there has to be at least 1,250 in Minnesota, but we're up around 2,700 now.
Okay.
And in Wisconsin and Michigan, all that was required is about 100 between the two states combined, and they're up around 1,600 or so, maybe 1,700. So we're pretty far above the limits that would cause them to become, or what biologists have decided, determined would cause them to maybe become more endangered. So we're pretty far above that.
David Meech joining us, senior research scientist with the U.S. Geological Survey, also author of The Wolf, the Ecology and Behavior of an Endangered Species, co-author of The Wolves of Denali, and of course his latest book, Wolf Island, Discovering the Secrets of a Mythical Animal. I will take the last bit of this interview I'm going to fanboy on you. I have loved the International Wolf Center. I have been going there every year. We are members. It's up in Ely. If you haven't been, everyone, it is truly an amazing site to visit. I am hard pressed to think of another community the size of Ely that has anything as special as this. You were the founder of the International Wolf Center. First of all, wonderful work. What prompted you to come up with the idea for it?
Well, as you've already mentioned, wolves have been a controversial animal for many, many years. And, there's a lot of people who really, especially early on, really disliked wolves and thought we shouldn't have any at all. And then there's a lot of other people who can appreciate, their beauty and charm and all that. And so the extreme viewpoints sort of fostered a lot of propaganda about wolves, much of which wasn't really true. And we wanted to get the facts out there. I mean, we were learning the facts, and I had this project going on in Minnesota at that time. That was in the late 60s, early 70s and 80s, and it's still going. But anyway, on that project, we were turning up a lot of new information, and I was intent on making sure that the public was able to access good, accurate, science-based information about wolves. So it was logical to set up a special wolf center to promote that.
I will say I know you guys just did the remodel there. Well, did it a few years ago. It's truly a wonderful setup. You've done this. You do take both sides of it. And I think that, you know, can I say a mission accomplished to a point? Because with the International Wolf Center, with the education, as you pointed out, we've brought the species back to a point where delisting it is not necessarily a bad thing. And I think that isn't that really the sign of success, is that you have educated the public and you've also looked after the species as a whole?
Well, certainly I'd say that recovery has been a success. And we like to think that our efforts in educating the public about it contributed to that, surely.
Yeah. I that is truly a wonderful place. If you've got young kids, I love how you do not treat them as dogs. You do your best up there. They do the best up there treating these animals as the wild animals they are. And it's interesting, just to tell you how good this place is, I have talked over the years to many of the kids that go up there and work, and they come out of college themselves. And if you are researching wolves, it is pretty much the A-list number one place you want to go to work in the summer so you can get involved in it. I want to encourage everyone, if you can, go get a membership to the International Wolf Center. That really is a great site, sir.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate you saying that.
Well, Wolf Island, once again, discovering the secrets of a mythical animal. This is with David Meach and also with Greg Brining, the forward by Rolf O. Peterson, and it is available pretty much everywhere from University of Minnesota Press. By all means, Dave, come on back. Anytime you have a wolf book, we can definitely talk about this for as long as you like. I'd love to have you back on the air.
Well, thank you so much. I'd like to do that.
All righty. You're listening to the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. If you ever listen to my show, you know I love two things, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I love history. And this next book here is an exceptional book. I actually highly recommend this one. Tom Weber joins us. Minneapolis, an Urban Biography is his latest book. Of course, an award-winning writer, journalist, radio host, author of 100 Things to Do in the Twin Cities Before You Die. And he's kind enough to join us today. Hey, Tom.
Good to see you. How are you?
I'm doing very well. You definitely, I like your writing because you capture this city very well.
Thank you. I mean, that's it, for whatever it's worth, it's actually very nice to hear that, because amidst all the things we're going to talk about with the book, it's been very bizarre to actually have a book out during the pandemic, because it means that we haven't had any events that were in person. And so I've actually had people ask me, how's the book going? And I honestly don't know, because I don't get any feedback, because I don't see people in person. So I know that's not the point of you saying that, but that actually is very gratifying to hear, and I appreciate it.
Well, I'll tell you what, it is. It's very well-done book in the way that you lay it out, because let's start off with the title, an urban biography. What's, in your mind, the difference between a regular biography and an urban biography?
It's actually a product that came from the Minnesota Historical Society Press. So they came up with that name, and it's because they're actually doing four of these books. So they're doing an urban biography for Minneapolis, for St. Paul, for Duluth, and for Rochester. And Minneapolis, my book, and Duluth both came out this year. And then next year, we'll have St. Paul and Rochester. So some of that phrase is just a way to brand it, because there's going to be this four set by the end of next year that has these stories. But I actually like the idea of calling a book about a place a biography, because it makes the city itself not human. I mean, that's a little silly to go that far, but it makes it a real pronounced character in the book, so to say. And, you know, what's a biography? It's the story of someone's life. This is a biography. It's the story of this city's life.
The way you lay this out, because I think that there are sometimes a lot of history books where, oh, Minneapolis was found because of the river. And, you know, you kind of get this very congenial school-esque type of layout of history. The reality is that history is never that easy to understand, and it's never that easy to kind of follow. And there's always a lot of stories that kind of get lost, that if you get someone who's a talented writer and can put them in perspective and put them in order in an effective way, it gives you a much better understanding of certain elements of the community. You do start it off here by talking, though, about the fact that, you know, it was Bedote. This was not – there wasn't a city forecast here. It was an outpost for the military with Native Americans controlling the lands.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, because if you look at – I actually, as you know, I make passing reference to the Ice Age in the book, because really, literally the way that the world melted in this part of the world, reason why Minneapolis exists where it does today, that's where the waterfall ended up, St. Anthony Falls. But it also, because of the way that the ice melted, this is also an area of the world where two major rivers converge. You have the Mississippi and the Minnesota River down at what most of us know as Fort Snelling. There's the state park down there. Maybe you've even taken a hike on Pike Island down there. But long before it had those names, this was the center of the world. And I mean that quite literally, the center of the world for the Dakota people, who were here for millennia before any of the white people showed up to start to colonize. And so It's mind-boggling to think that you have Minneapolis, which in its history since, you know, the 1800s and to now, Minneapolis was absolutely the last major city between here and, you know, Seattle, the West Coast, in many ways. Mm-hmm. And it was the hub for all of that farming activity that happened out to the west, even into the Dakotas. All of those goods came in down the river, in through Minneapolis, all the logging, lumber. So you had this major hub, but for centuries before that, this was a very sacred and central place to the Dakota people as well. And so I feel like, you know, you talk about all the land that was stolen, which it definitely was, but I think one of the other things we took our cues from in terms of the Dakota people, is that we made this place the center of our world, too, just as the Dakota had done for generations.
Yeah, and when you put it in perspective like that, when you see people getting furious because Fort Snelling is referring to the land as Bedote, or we change the name of the lake to Bede-Mikaska, you know, it's kind of like, you know, this was thousands of years. This is what it was known as. This is only a modern incarnation. I'm sorry you're so upset about this, but yeah. I think we can get over that.
Well, the most ridiculous part about the Bede-Mikaska story was, if you recall, there was a rather wealthy homeowner near the lake who didn't want the name to change back, and he wrote an op-ed in the Minneapolis in the Star Tribune that said, "Why are we doing this? What is the great contribution that the Dakota people have made to Minnesota that justifies putting this name back to Bede-Mikaska?" And what's so ridiculous about that statement isn't just the concept of the statement, but the fact that he used a Dakota word in the sentence. You want to know what one of the contributions was that the Dakota made to Minnesota? The word Minnesota is a Dakota word. So, like, where what are we doing here? That's what I want to know.
I always love Bedote. Okay, that's Mendota. You know, it was the French right. Translating Bedote, and the English translated the French to Mendota. So you might as well change that name too if you're so offended. But you know, it's the it, it, I. I think that this is a part of the history. And the good thing that's starting to happen in Minnesota is we're starting to understand that history and incorporate that history far more as we should when we talk about the history of the area. I also like how, you know, water is here and this brought people here and growth and opportunity. The reality is the combination, the conjuncture of industry growth and immigrant growth. When you're talking about cities growing, I mean, there's a lot of cities that started that just never grew. But Minneapolis did, and granted, it did have the waterfall, which did create power. But the reality is it was the industries that were here and the immigrant populations that came to work for those industries that really made the city start to grow larger and larger.
Absolutely. And if you live in Minneapolis or the Twin Cities, frankly, and you don't know the story of Bohemian Flats, tell it a little bit in the book, but by all means, you should do your own, you know, research out there in the world too. This was a very it was bohemian, as we think of in the lowercase version of the word bohemian today. Gathering of immigrants just downriver from where all these flour mills and lumber mills were setting up shop, right by the St. Anthony Falls. A little bit downriver, land that is now, frankly, surrounded by the University of Minnesota campus, you had this Bohemian Flats where people, immigrants showed up, and as hard as it was to live there, and frankly, it flooded a lot because the river, you know, was not something that was as easily controlled as it is today. And today, I would argue, it's not very easily controlled either, but, you know, easily flooded. It was a hard scrabble life. And frankly, people showed up, they got cheated. They were told, yeah, go up. This plot will be there, and the plot doesn't exist. So they literally went into the river to bring up mud from the bottom of the river to create land that they could build their house on. So think about how simple that would be. I mean, it just tells that story. And then fast forward to the 1980s, when Minneapolis is now in the second or third decade of decline in population, who are the people who saved Minneapolis and turned around that population decline? It was immigrants. Mm-hmm. It was Mexican and Hispanic immigrants coming here. You had a wave of black people coming from the Rust Belt area. You had Hmong refugees and Somali refugees and other East Africans and West Africans. And that's the reason why in 1990 we started to turn our phones. We actually started to gain people again. In Minneapolis, it's always been the immigrants who build the city.
Mm-hmm. I love when I read a history book and there's a piece of history I never knew about. I love the raid in Minneapolis in 1890. The crime. I'll let you explain what crime was being violated in Minneapolis in 1890.
Well, it had to do, of all things, it had nothing to do with. Minneapolis, you know, St. Paul gets a lot of credit, if you want to use that word, for being a hub later on in life in the 30s and 20s and 30s as being a hub for gangsters and organized crime. And it absolutely was. Let's not take anything away from that part of history for St. Paul. But Minneapolis had an incredibly fair share of that as well. And this was a very corrupt city in the early part of the 20th century in terms of how the government ran and things like that. But none of that is why this happened in 1890. There was no organized crime being broken up. There was no, illegal sex work or prostitution, as they would have called it back then. What it was census fraud. And that's right, census, as in that thing we do every 10 years to count the people. And the reason for that is because Minneapolis and St. Paul, St. Paul actually became a city officially a few years before Minneapolis, but because of the mills on the river there in Minneapolis, and because, like you just mentioned, all those immigrants coming in, both cities just exploded in population in the years leading up to 1880. And actually in 1880, the census showed that Minneapolis had more people, but it was so close, like it was only a few thousand, that it was really anyone's guess who would take the lead in 1890. And so both cities cheated. I mean, they cheated. They added people. There were people living in Union Depot. Like they were making up people. There were people being given a list of names and said, here's a list of names who people we know live in Minneapolis. now go add some relatives just from off. And so the raid was literally people from St. Paul coming over from the magistrate's office or from the, you know, from the judicial office, coming over to Minneapolis to arrest people and take them back to St. Paul. And man, that just started, you know, it gets to the point that the rivalry between Minneapolis and St. Paul was so fierce for so long. You know, today when we talk about the Minneapolis-St. Paul rivalry, it's really just good-natured, right? It's just kind of gentle, you know, you're just kind of poking each other just because it's fun. But man, oh man, it was a legit thing. We didn't have the global market. You know, our adversaries or our economic opponents weren't in another country. They were the city next door, and you were always buying for the next industry or the next business. And so that's why that raid happened in 1890.
Well, and it was, we're always going to get this. Whenever you had, I mean, you had organized crime basically told in St. Paul, you guys can reside here. You just got to go rob them. And when you had that, although you also dedicate a bit to Doc Ames, who is truly, you know, to understand a city, you not only have to look at the great leaders you have, but you have to look at the pretty bad ones too. Doc Ames was an atrocious mayor of Minneapolis.
There is a book just about Doc Ames, too, by the way, and I don't remember the exact title, but if you look up Doc Ames, it is mentioned in my book, but there's actually a separate book just about Doc Ames and his reign that's absolutely worth your time. And what happened was Doc Ames actually was the Grover Cleveland of Minneapolis mayors because he served several non-consecutive terms as mayor. He when he came to office in 1900, it was his fourth time being mayor, and he had switched back and forth between political parties as well. And on the day he was inaugurated, and this is how it was back then, it always is, the mayor of Minneapolis, when you win the election, the inauguration is usually January 1st. Sometimes it's the second or third. Sometimes they move it just a little bit, but it's basically the first of the year. So Doc Ames gets sworn in. Hey, I'm glad to be here. And then that night, the first thing he does as mayor is he fires half of the police force. And the reason he did that, he fired half the officers in the city. And the reason he did that was that he wanted to put his own cronies in those jobs. And he was hiring people who were, you know, his political supporters, but they were saloon keepers, right? They had no experience in any kind of law enforcement, and they became the police department. And there were a lot of other leaders who weren't fired who were demoted. Like there was one captain, I think, who was demoted basically to janitor of the police station. No, I'm not touting making that. That's actually what happened. He became the janitor. And the reason he did that is because he wanted the police then to help him with organized crime, to do the crime. I need to go criming, so I need this police force to help me. And so that's how it was helped. That's how they turned a blind eye when people were bringing in slot machines or what have you. And then whenever that happened, there were kickbacks that went all the way up to City Hall. It was atrocious.
When you talk about history, too, and I think one of the things I think is overlooked a lot of times is when you talk about an overall history book – is the relatively modern history. And you don't pull any punches about the renewal of Minneapolis, the building of, you know, the big high-rises, the expansion of the suburbs, the building of the interstates. You also bring in the voices of the city that started to rise in the civil rights movement. And I think, there's a lot of things that create a city. And you can't deny these things, whether good or bad, as regard of renewal or the beginning of the multicultural of voices that we started to hear out of the city, both added in their own way to the city of Minneapolis.
You know, and it's important to remember, too, that there definitely has been renewal. You know, downtown by the river, you know, where the Guthrie Theater now stands mm-hmm. and where all those lofts are, right? Like, that is a success story in part of the story of Minneapolis, because it was an area that really had been forgotten. You know, General Mills moved out to Golden Valley in the 60s, and, you know, Pillsbury, you know, all those mills eventually closed. And so it was it was a hard scrabble part of town right there in downtown along the river. And so when you have this rebirth, that is great, except then you have to ask the question of how many of those lofts that they built or how many of those apartment buildings actually had affordable housing, affordable mm-hmm. units in them. The answer is not much and practically zero in many of those buildings. But then you also have to say, okay, that's great. There's no reason not to celebrate that there was that rebirth in some parts of Minneapolis. But throughout all of that time, for example, the disparities between white people and people of color just never changed. They really have always been there. We've just gotten better in the last generation or so at measuring it and being able to tell that story. But frankly, that story was being told as well. You just have to look for it. And so Minneapolis has had some fantastic, wonderful chapters where good things happen. But through it all, and this is really how I frame the book, like the whole point of the book is to say, we're this wonderful place that people think is a best kept secret as a place to live, and everyone who moves here stays here, that kind of a thing. But why do we then have these crippling disparities? And in some cases, they're the largest gaps in the country. You talk about, you know, school, how students do in school, white students versus, you know, black and brown students. You talk about home ownership for black people. Black home ownership is the lowest in Minneapolis. I think it's Minneapolis and St. Paul, but it's Minneapolis as any metro in the country. Mm-hmm. So why is that? And that was the goal in telling some of those stories that maybe you weren't as familiar with.
And maybe I spent some time on my local town in Hopkins in the Planning and Zoning Committee, and you just said it exactly. And if you tie what you've written in with what Mayor Hodges recently said about the fact that there's a lot of people in Minneapolis that love the idea of affordable housing, but just not next to them. And then you look at, okay, sure, we're tearing up these large swaths of the city, but does it really do us any good to have extremely expensive apartments that are only Airbnbs for the most part? Is that really – and especially when you have the need within the African-American, the Latino, the American – Native American communities that they need housing as well. I think that is – you have to understand that point because you can't solve the problems unless you understand how you got there.
And that's really the goal of the book, and that's what I say, you know – in theory, I could have tried at the end of the book to say, well, here's five things we should do to address this. But I don't feel like I'm smart enough to get at that. Mm-hmm. So what I did instead was to say, this is step one, I guess. Maybe that's the way of looking at it. And to say that if you don't know this history, that's a problem in and of itself, even if you're very earnestly trying to solve these problems. You know, we have parts of this city, you know, there is a house in Prospect Park that was built and became the scene of a race riot. And it wasn't, you know, frankly, and this is not a fair representation, but frankly, when people hear the phrase race riot, they assume that it's black and brown people who are doing the rioting. Not in 1909. Mm-hmm. In 1909, the race riot was white people going up to this house that was being built because they didn't want this black family to move in. So if you live in Prospect Park, you probably walk past that house, which does still stand to this day, every day on your daily walk if you're taking the dog for a walk. And you need to know that history is there. Frankly, the existence of Prospect Park today mm-hmm. is part of the story, because if you ever look at a map of Minneapolis and St. Paul and look at the route that I-94 takes, as it comes out of downtown Minneapolis, it makes this little jut that we can all imagine when we're actually on the highway, when we're driving. You go past where the U of M is. There's this little kind of zigzag. It's not really a zigzag, but it's this little deviation before it becomes a pretty straight line between Minneapolis and St. Paul. And the reason for that is because Prospect Park, if you just draw a straight line from Minneapolis and St. Paul for building a highway, Prospect Park should be gone. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, because it was a Tony neighborhood, and frankly, the mayor at the time lived in Prospect Park. So the question is, who has that access to power and the ability to make those decisions when really major, long-lasting decisions like where we're going to dig a highway are made.
Minneapolis and Urban Biography, Tom Weber, kind enough to join us. An excellent book. I highly, highly recommend this book, especially if you're a fan of history and a fan of Minneapolis. It is a great book. Tom, congratulations on this. By all means, please come back the next time you have another one.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for the chat. I appreciate it.
Tom Weber, kind enough to join us. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Once again, thank you very much to Tom Weber, Minneapolis and Urban Biography. Earlier, David Meach, Wolf Island, thank you very much. Enjoy your weekend. We are back on Monday. The brand new Matt McNeil Show starts in the 4 p.m. hour on Monday. Have a great weekend. Thanks for being here for all the brand new to you shows. And until Monday, see ya.